Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science girl, and today we are going to be discussing technology for science, more specifically, robot technology. I'm broadcasting today live from San Francisco and have a few special guests from one of the biggest conferences dedicated to science and geoscience, the American Geophysical Union, or AGU. It's an annual meeting held every December in San Francisco, and this year it's especially large as the Society for Marine Mammalogy is also holding its biannual conference. Being surrounded by some of the world's greatest scientists is inspiring, and I am so pleased to be here in the heart of it. We have a great show, so without further ado, I want to jump right into it. To start, we're going to be going to our oceans, talking with Nick Bingham, lead electrical engineer for Schmidt Ocean Institute, who is currently building a 4,500-meter robotic vehicle, the ROV. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon, Carly.
We're so happy to be here, Nick. So first, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to work as an engineer for Schmidt Ocean Institute?
I moved here specifically to work with the Schmidt Ocean Institute. My background, I've worked with an underwater vehicle before, developing electrical systems for it. And so when I learned that you guys had a non-profit out here focusing on oceanographic research, and especially that you were building these subsea vehicles with a specific science bent, then that really interested me. So that's how I ended up working at the Schmidt Ocean Institute.
And electrical engineering, I mean, what made you excited to work in that field? Did you always want to be an electrical engineer, or when did you know that that was something that you were really interested in working on?
It wasn't quite a childhood calling. I think it came out after I'd chosen to study something else at university, so often the case, and so you switch it around and you end up doing what you love. So my advice is do what you love from the beginning.
Well, that is very good advice. And for those of our listeners that, you know, might not have worked with an electrical engineer before, what are the typical types of things that you do in your job?
Right. It can actually vary a lot between projects. With this particular project, development of the underwater vehicles, we do a lot of research and specification. There's not a lot of hands-on work at the start of the project. So a lot of the design only exists in our computers and in our minds, but as we progress through the design, eventually we reach a point where a lot of our systems are being delivered and installed, and we will debug problems, identify faults. But for the development of this project, it's largely a design project for us.
Excellent. And so now working on this ROV, we hear a lot about underwater robotics that people are using now. Tell us, what is an ROV exactly, and how does that differ from an AUV?
Right, good question. So the ROV stands for Remotely Operated Vehicle, and that means it's typically tethered to the support ship by an umbilical cable, and it's flown by a pilot who's sitting in comfort on board the support ship. So ROVs are normally pretty ugly, boxy vehicles, about the size of a car. The AUV, on the other hand, means Autonomous Underwater Vehicle, and that means it has some sort of programmatic intelligence on board, which means it can operate independently with fewer or sometimes even no commands from its operators. The AUVs are often torpedo or surfboard shaped because they're optimized for efficiency moving through the water frequently. And unlike the ROV, they're free swimming, so it avoids a lot of the engineering challenges related to the tether.
Gotcha. So basically, one of the main things is with or without a cable that attaches it to the ship that it's working off of.
Right, that's the biggest difference.
Okay, excellent. And, you know, they have different roles too, right? So what exactly is the ROV going to do that you're building?
Right. The role of an ROV is typically to investigate specific sites. So an AUV might be optimized for surveying, but with an ROV, often the ship will hold position on the surface and will lower the ROV over the side of the ship or over the back of the ship using a crane. And then we can conduct midwater sampling with the ROV in the water on its way, on its descent to the bottom. And we can see, make chemical measurements or find midwater creatures. But really, most of what we'll investigate with the ROV is on the ocean floor. This is where the bulk of the life is, and that's what the vehicle's been optimized for. So as well as physical sampling that we might do with cores that we can push to take sediment samples, or manipulator arms that we can use to collect rocks. A lot of our data, a lot of our outcomes from a dive is actually the video footage. So we'll be equipping this vehicle with very high resolution 4K video cameras and an excellent lighting system, because we found that, as far as science is concerned, that's really useful information for us.
That's so interesting. And I think I've heard you refer to it as a creature feature before, looking at some of those underwater imagery. I mean, we've looked at some of the ROV footage that we've collected on other cruises with MidOcean Institute using ROVs before, and it's amazing what you see. Last year, we discovered the world's deepest fish. How does it feel to be building something that will be on the edge of potentially discovery?
Yeah, the discovery aspect in these regions is pretty amazing. I was at the Monterey Bay Aquarium last weekend, and I learned of the spook fish, which is one of these deeper fishes that has its eyes inside a gelatinous dome. And creatures like this just can't be captured with a lander or a static thing. It's only by being able to move the vehicle and pilot the vehicle down there that we get to discover things like this. And yeah, that's awesome for me. I'm in it for the critters for sure.
It's still just amazing how much we don't know about the bottom of the ocean, and having these vehicles is so important to be able to go to those depths and explore. Why was the depth of 4,500 meters selected for this vehicle?
Mm-hmm. The depth of 4,500 meters is selected because we really wanted to get our first vehicle for the Institute up and running quite quickly to be able to start using it on our cruises off the RV Falkor, which is our research support ship for it. By limiting this first vehicle to 4,500 meters, it means we can still explore a huge percentage of the ocean floor, maybe 70% or more, but it means we don't run into any of the consequences or penalties or the design challenges that come with these really deep diving vehicles that might go to 6,000 meters or 11,000 meters. When we design these systems, the pressure that's seen by components at the bottom of the ocean is the same as it's introduced by all of the weight of the water on top of it. So as you can imagine, the deeper we go, the more challenging it is to design around these problems. 4,500 meters is a great starting point.
And I imagine even at 4,500 meters, there are certain challenges that the ocean poses that you need to take into consideration when building the vehicle. You mentioned pressure. What are some of the things you have to design or keep in mind in regards to that pressure when you're working on an ROV?
Mm-hmm. So unlike a submarine you might be familiar with, which has a pressure hull and the entire of the inside is space fit for human occupation, when we're designing the ROV, we'll decide which areas need to support the pressure of the ocean outside so that we can have ambient pressure, so that we can have atmospheric pressure inside, and which areas of the ROV we can allow to just see the ocean pressure without regard. So the vehicle itself is more of an empty frame than a tubular hull, like you might imagine. But within that frame, we fit all of our components, our thrusters, and for the electronics for this first vehicle, to be able to use off-the-shelf electronics, we put it in a titanium cylinder, or two titanium cylinders in this case. And this allows us to design and test our electronics exactly as we would use them on the surface. Then installed in this cylinder, the cylinder will protect it from the crushing pressure of the ocean around it by withstanding that pressure, leaving an airspace with electronics inside.
Those are all important considerations. And I was lucky enough to visit one of the syntactic foam factories that's building the foam for the ROV. And, you know, it's those little details that you don't really think about when building a vehicle, but are so interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about the foam that floats the ROV and why it's special? And it's not just regular styrofoam you're using to build this thing.
That's right. So did you get to hold a piece of the foam at the factory, Carly?
I did. It was very cool.
Did it feel anything like foam?
You know, it was a little bit harder than I expected. It was a little heavy, but then also seeing the product before it's put together, it's this really weird powder that looks like a liquid, but it's not. It's very curious.
Right. So the syntactic foam that feels a little bit like concrete is actually a suspension of glass microspheres or glass microballoons, only a couple of microns in diameter, in a epoxy resin. So it's Carly mentioned, it's poured in like this slurry and cast into molds. And what that leaves us with is the air volume inside each microsphere displaces the water and provides us with buoyancy. And the epoxy exists largely to kind of form it into blocks that we can cut and hold on to and to protect the microspheres. So this gives us blocks that feel really heavy, but to float in the ocean, you're allowed to be quite heavy. You just have to be lighter than the water. And if you imagine a similar sized amount of water to the block, then that's actually quite heavy. So we create a vehicle that weighs about 3 tons in the air, but it actually floats in the water.
Well, you described that very well, better than the really cool foam thingy that I touched. So that's fantastic. And I'm excited to see it shaped too, because even though it's hard, when it's put together, they can still cut it to whatever design or shape that you want.
Right, exactly. So we'll be having it cast in square blocks that can be most easily glued together. And then the entire outside profile will be cut on a computer-controlled cutting machine to any shape we like. So it's going to incorporate some important features to allow us to fit our vertical thrusters in there. It's a feature for the docking head, which captures it back on the ship to seat in. And got a kind of a bumper bar for our lights at the front. And I would like to put a tail on the back, but stylistic influences.
So if you had your way, what color would you want the ROV to be?
I think the lime green I'd seen is my first choice.
Excellent. Well, I think it's supposed to be a yellow color, which will look really nice and sharp in the water. But who knows? There's lots of vehicles to decide. Maybe there'll be a pink vehicle one day. And so going back to the design a little bit, for those who have never seen an ROV, you know, it's hard on radio to show what a vehicle would look like. What's the best way you can describe it? Like, to me, the ROV looks a bit like a technological ROV for the water with some really cool video cameras on it. Can you illustrate a little bit in your imagination what it looks like?
Yeah, it's about the size of a small car, and the top third of it is this foam pack, so it's going to be a solid color, lime green ideally. And the bottom two-thirds of it is going to be an aluminium anodized frame, so kind of like a black metal structure. And to that, we attach all of the equipment we need. So the bottom half of it really is this functional beast. There's no swooping curves here. We've got our titanium cylinders and a hydraulic pump in the bottom of it to maximize our lower our center of gravity, center of buoyancy. Then in the middle, we've got provision for a lot of science equipment. So we've actually got deliberately planned empty space, which is one of the big things that differentiates us from a lot of commercial vehicles, the ability to do things with it. Then towards the front, we've got two big machine from titanium manipulator arms. So it looks, I guess, like a grasshopper, a praying mantis with the arms out the front, which can collect samples. And they've got access to our sample trays, which slide out, a bio box, things like that. And then above that, we have cameras and lights and other water sampling instrumentation.
I love the praying mantis description. That's perfect. That illustrates it really, really well. And, you know, listeners can go on to the Schmidt Ocean website and see the ROV image very soon. So, now you said before that there's pilots that drive it. How would you drive such a vehicle? I'm assuming you don't put people on it and there's no steering wheel. So how do you get the thing to move in the water?
Steering wheel, that's good. I'll pass that feedback on. So if you look inside the control room on the support ship RV Falkor, it's got a video wall with 10 or 20 video monitors and four big chairs and a bench waiting for our controls to be installed. So we'll have probably a pilot and a navigator and a co-pilot and a video operator, who will all have access to 10 screens in front of them showing the main pilot cam for steering the vehicle, as well as sonar displays, a heads-up display for their computer controls, and other cameras on the vehicle, things like that. And in front of the pilot, he actually flies the vehicle with a joystick. So it's, I guess it's not unlike a computer game if you're moving this joystick and the result is the picture in front of you. It's hard to imagine that in between that is the real world, a vehicle on the end of 5 or 4 kilometres of cable beneath the ocean. But you've got to separate and realise that what you're doing is in fact real. You move this joystick and you're cameras will move correspondingly on the screen in front as the vehicle moves through the water.
So will you get an opportunity to drive it, or is there some kind of special training that you need to be able to drive the ROV?
Right. We're not sure who's first to be unleashed on this. So a lot of the engineers have been involved with the design of it. Initially, we're going to be the most familiar with the software. But that said, a lot of us have never piloted a vehicle like this in our life. So would you hand the keys to this brand new ROV to someone who's never flown one before? To drive these vehicles, it's really almost a profession in itself. So our ROV pilots, and we call them pilot techs because no one gets to be the rock star pilot in isolation. You have to be a technician as well. You have to be able to fix everything. They will have probably a lot of on-the-job training, and a lot of experience from flying these sort of vehicles before. And as I mentioned, they've also got to have a technical background for basic electrical repairs, working on the hydraulic system, and generally just making stuff work.
That sounds about right. And it sounds like a very interesting job. And if you ever need someone to pilot the ROV, I would love the opportunity to try a hand at that. But the ROV is not quite built yet, so we're not quite at the piloting stage. Tell us a little bit where we're at with the vehicle, what components have been built so far.
Okay. So most of our, because the vehicle is a custom design for Schmidt Ocean Institute, most of our components can be custom designed so that the frame and the shape of the foam pack, things like this, we have to start processes like sourcing material and casting the blocks of foam a long time in advance. Some of this stuff takes 6 or 9 months or more, so that's been started. But as for actually cutting it to shape or welding up a frame, there is nothing yet. We're keeping the ultimate design flexibility by leaving it on the computer. Very early next year, we're going to start on the assembly of the frame. So this has been engineered in consultation with our fabricator, and it's also been fairly closely scrutinized using what we call finite element analysis, which is a way to predict how the forces will affect the structure even before it's made. So that'll start construction in early next year, and we should also receive the foam pack. We've got manipulator arms out the factory that we've been testing, and there's also a few lights and cameras kicking around. And if we've done our job well, it should all bolt together like a piece of IKEA furniture in February, March 2016.
That sounds great. And I want to hear all about what's going to happen next with the ROV once you do build all the components. Where do you test it, or do you just put it out in the ocean and that's it?
No, absolutely. With any big engineering project like this, there's inevitably teething problems. So there's a lot of testing and qualification that gets to happen before it gets to Falkor. The first thing we'll be doing is a dry run in the factory. We'll test the high voltage transmission through the umbilical cable. We'll test a few instruments. We'll test all our cameras, our lights, things like that. We're testing our hydraulic systems. That's before it rolls out of the factory. And then we've got a fairly close relationship with Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, that's Imbari, down in Moss Landing. And these guys have got a fairly big test tank there. It's about 30 or 40 feet in each dimension with a crane for being able to hoist things in and out of the tank. So we'll be rolling our vehicle out of the factory and trucking it and its support container down to Monterey Bay. See these guys have agreed to let us test it in their tank, and we'll be hoisting it into the tank, and that's where it really gets a run for its money. See what the thrusters can do. Do some hot laps, but only short ones.
It must be such an intense period when you first put the ROV in the test tank for the first time and see how it runs in the water.
Yes, very nerving. Very nerving for the engineers.
I had that. Well, and then so from the test tank, where does it go after that? Then does it go into the ocean?
Yes, it's time. We might do some harbor testing in California, or we may send it to Guam for mobilization on the Falkor, because that will be its first cruise, is what we call a science verification cruise, where we really test out all of the performance of the vehicle, bring in some of our visiting scientists who are likely to get cruises with the vehicle so they can know exactly what to expect, and we can try things out and check the performance. That one should be a lot of fun, because suddenly you have the free reign of the ocean, not constrained in a fish tank.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm really excited to hear what happens and to be part of that in Guam, see what you guys come up with the science verification cruises and the testing. Love to learn a little bit more about the ROV, Nick. You've done such a great job of describing the process and what an ROV is. We're going to take a quick traffic break. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about technology for the seas and science technology.
Good news from Dynavite. New Nomo Flea flea and tick spray kills fleas and ticks with no poison. New Nomo Flea is totally safe for dogs, cats, puppies, kittens, kids, babies crawling on the carpet, and even you. Because it's made from vegetable oil. Nomo Flea dissolves the hard shell of a flea or tick on contact, so the moist insides of that flea or tick just dry up.
No fleas.
No more flea instantly. No more ticks soon thereafter. Best of all, no more poison, ever. So as of today, you can stop using imidacloprid, moxidectin, pyrethrin, and all those other flea and tick poisons. Get all the grisly nitty-gritty about fleas and ticks, or before your beloved pet ventures out in the backyard again, order a 30 or 60-day supply of new Nomo Flea. Just click the pic of the dead flea on Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
A message from DAV to returning veterans. Thank you for doing your duty and doing our bidding. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way and putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for defending our freedom and displaying your honor. DAV thanks all veterans by fighting to get them the benefits and support they were promised. Visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we're talking about technology for the seas and robot technology. With us now is Nick Bingham, the electrical engineer for the robotic operated vehicle that Schmidt Ocean Institute is currently building. So, Nick, we were chatting about the ROV, and you did a great job of walking us through what the vehicle looks like and what the vehicle is going to be able to do and the really unique parts that are on the vehicle. And we said, you said you're going to test it in the tank first before it goes to the ocean, and then you do some science verification in the ocean. What next after that? So once all the tests have been completed and the ROV checks out, where will it be used?
Okay. So the vehicle will operate off the RV Falkor, which is the Institute's research vessel, and that ship operates mostly in the Pacific Ocean, but no reason it can't go further. The vehicle itself, as I mentioned before, the ROVs are really optimized for investigating specific sites of interest. So based on the proposals that our scientists provide, we'll visit sites of interest up to 4,500 meters deep. And so in general, if I describe one of these sites for you, it's going to be dark and cold because the sunlight stops at about couple of hundred meters in, and it's near freezing down there. So they're all going to be very similar in that regard, but We know that they're very diverse in terms of life, depending on where you go with the vehicle. So that's what's exciting for us to find out.
Now, we talked a lot about how the vehicle is adapted for pressures at sea and how you need to take that into consideration. And different vehicles have different depth ratings. What are the differences between building a ROV for 400 to 500 meters versus, let's say, full ocean depth 11,000 meters?
Right. So if you balance a jug of water on your head and you imagine how heavy that is, and then you make it a tower of jugs of water 4,500 meters high, the pressure you feel on the top of your head is the pressure that all the components in our vehicles will see. And so if we go from 4,500 meters down to 11,000 meters, we more than double the pressure seen by every component. So that means in terms of the titanium pressure vessels I was describing before, these need to be thicker walled and heavier, so there are buoyancy penalties with that. In terms of electrical systems, it makes connecting wires and optical fibers from the inside to the outside of these pressure vessels much harder. So it limits the options there. And in generally, there's just greater overheads in terms of weight penalty, buoyancy penalty, reliability, connectorization, the deeper and deeper we go. So we'll design quite differently for each of these depths. At 11,000 meters, we still will have pressure vessels, but we try to use what we call pressure-tolerant electronics, which is where we design every circuit board and every component to withstand the ambient pressure of the ocean at those depths. So we can just install them in plastic boxes filled with a fluid like oil to stop them compressing, rather than having to withstand the ocean pressure with a titanium pressure vessel. The other main differences with depths like this mechanically, it means a syntactic foam is going to be more dense because we need more epoxy to support the microballoons than we can have microballoons themselves. We run into strange challenges with things like the umbilical cable, because by the time you get to 11,000 meters at the bottom of the ocean, a constant diameter steel cable can't support its own weight. So often vehicles for these depths might be battery powered rather than powered from the ship, which means we can run a very lightweight tether with just fiber optic fibers in it for communications without needing to bring any power down. And of course, the deeper we go, once we go past about 6,000 meters, which is where most of the current oil and gas exploration stops, we lose almost all commercially available equipment. So almost everything has to be purpose designed.
Well, and I bet it's also extremely difficult to move in those environments that, you know, you have no light, lots of pressure. How do you navigate when you're down there? Are you using video or are you using GPS, or how do you move the vehicle once it's at those depths?
Yeah, it's a lot of different techniques. So we don't get GPS underwater. So the trained pilots really, when they're on the bottom, they'll use features to navigate by video, and on their piloting screen at the surface, we give them a navigational plot that's using what we call an inertial navigation system. So we get feedback from many sources, including measuring the movement of the vehicle, measuring its acceleration and its rotation. We also triangulate it with acoustic pings from the ship on the surface. We call that USBL, or ultra short baseline location. And we also have what we call a Doppler velocity log, or DVL, which is a instrument that acoustically scans the seafloor and watches it moving past, a lot like how the mouse on your computer works with a little red light underneath. So we've got a system that combines all of these sources of information to calculate the position very accurately, often down to about 1 meter precision, that we can plot on the display for the operator. So it allows them to return to the same place with reasonable precision and know where they're going and do what they need to do.
Sure. So how fast can the vehicle actually move in the water then?
All right. So the vehicle we're building is basically a brick with propellers, Carly. Because we can bring practically unlimited power down the tether from the ship, there's very little incentive to optimize for hydrodynamic performance through the water. Instead, we optimize the vehicle for the payload it can carry, or how easy it is to get it on and off the ship, things like that. So its top speed might be around 5 knots. That's about 5 miles per hour in the water.
Hey, you've got a lot of pressure, no pun intended. Slow and steady wins the race. And so it takes a village, you know, it's obviously not one person. Tell me a little bit more about the people working on the ROV and the team you work with.
Right. It's a really small team. It's been built up specifically for this project. So in the engineering side, we've got a couple of mechanical guys, and so they've got various backgrounds from subsea and other places, and they'll be designing the frame. They do a large-scale design, which is kind of the frame and the buoyancy and what the vehicle will look like, but they also drill down to the intricate details like the O-rings and the connectors, stuff like this. So they cover everything in that regard. And then there's the electrical side of things, and we try and make a handoff point for this between the guys, but everyone's familiar with everything. There's a lot of overlap goes on here, which is pretty helpful. And we concentrate on electron janitoring, pushing the electrons around as necessary to power our instruments and get our video signals to the surface, all this kind of stuff. Then aside from engineering, we've also got a project manager who does a great job of keeping tabs on the budget and steering us in the right path in general. And of course, admin, we've got one girl helping us. She does a great job working in this, like on the factory floor with seven or eight guys for company, looking after all of our purchasing, chasing our suppliers, and just making sure all the right wheels are turning.
Excellent. Yeah, it sounds like it is a really great team working on this, and a lot of work for not a lot of people. So kudos on all of you. Now, is this the first ROV vehicle you've worked on before?
This is, in fact, the first ROV I've worked on before. I previously worked on a manned submersible, which is called the Deep Sea Challenger, which dived to the Marianas Trench in 2012. And so there's a lot of technology similarity between these. They use similar thrusters. That vehicle was battery-powered. So learning about the umbilical cable and high-voltage distribution through the cable, this sort of thing has been a little bit new for us, but we're up to speed. We've got a lot of good advice from the industry and should be working soon.
Sure. And we being a little modest there, that vehicle that you worked on previously was the first, it was the first manned one to go to full ocean depth, right? Or second one to full ocean depth. Why did you decide not to do a manned vehicle for this ROV?
Right. Good question. I would love to go down there 4,500 meters and see this stuff with my own eyes. There is definitely something to be said for that. But supporting meat bags at the bottom of the ocean is actually really difficult. We need a warm environment. We need somewhere to sit. We need air to breathe, things like that. And so robots don't care about any of that stuff. It makes it really easy. So we can just send them to these crushing pressures in freezing temperatures and then expect them to work there for, we stay down there for weeks or a month at a time. And they never complain. It's great. So in terms of getting science, getting the most science done for your dollar, these robots are the way of the future for that. It allows us to see more, bring back more samples, do things quicker and easily and with less risk as well, as opposed to sending humans down there to look with their own eyes. Less romantic, I admit, but sometimes that's the price we pay in the pursuit of science.
Well, I think this is a really nice opportunity because it allows everybody to see, right? You know, you're getting the video, and so it's not just one person, but lots of people get to explore and experience that. And I think you bring up a really important point in terms of the importance of the vehicle and exploration. Why do you think it's important to continue to explore our deep ocean?
Right. Yeah, I keep hearing the statistic that the oceans cover more of our planet than the land. And so in terms, and the difficulty to explore. So we've seen a lot of our land because we can walk there, but at the bottom of the ocean, a lot of us spend a lot of time on or in the water, but no one spends a lot of time underneath. It's just so difficult to get there. You can dive, and then you can use submarines and you can use these robots, but it really is relatively unexplored compared to all of the other places on our planet. And it has the processes that are going down there. Physical processes, geological, biological, all of these things have a bigger impact than most of us imagine on what happens for us above the water. And so we really need to understand that. We need to understand it just to satisfy our own curiosity, as well as to understand what things we can do that will change these effects that will, I guess, yes, it affects our footprint on the planet and ultimately our own existence here. So it's a really important research prospect.
Absolutely. Nick, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. I'm so excited to see the 4,500-meter ROV. Congratulations on all the hard work that you've already accomplished with the vehicle.
Thanks, Carly. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, moving from the ocean to the air, we are going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we'll be chatting with 3D Robotics.
Do shopping online and using public Wi-Fi make you vulnerable to identity theft? Does giving out your social security number put you at risk? Is your dog at risk of identity theft? Yes, yes, and no. Your dog has absolutely nothing to worry about. But we do live in a world that can expose a lot of personal information, and that can lead to having your identity stolen and losing everything you've worked for. That's why at LifeLock, we use proprietary technology to detect a wide variety of threats. And unlike free credit monitoring services, we have a dedicated U.S.-based staff to help restore your identity if it ever is compromised. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But if you ask yourself whether you're worth protecting with the best, isn't the answer a resounding yes? Plans start at $9.99 a month, and now you can get 10% off. Go to LifeLock.com and use promo code NEWS.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are in the heart of it all in San Francisco talking to amazing scientists here that have been participating in the AGU, the American Geophysical Union, and the Marine Mammal Conference. I'm really happy now to introduce my next guest, Greg Kretzinger from 3D Robotics, who is the academic liaison over at that institute or organization. And I had the pleasure of meeting Greg yesterday at the AGU booth. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Carly.
And I was just fascinated to learn a little bit about your company, which I hadn't heard of before. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about 3D Robotics?
Yeah, so 3DR, or 3D Robotics, is based out of Berkeley, California, and we were founded in 2007 by Chris Anderson and Jordi Munoz, who is out of Mexico. He's kind of an engineering prodigy, and Chris was former head of Wired magazine. They got together, and they were interested in building drones, and originally 3DR was mostly about kits. So you get a box of parts, and you would solder them together with an autopilot, which is kind of the brain. And you kind of have this flying contraption. And then if you fast forward a couple of years, we started building off-the-shelf platforms. So you could just go in and buy something that would fly out of the box. And then today we have our Solo platform, which is the world's first smart drone. So it's super easy, connected to the cloud. And we are growing rapidly. So we are several hundred people and North America's largest drone manufacturer.
Wow, so a lot in a short amount of time. And so these are commercially available vehicles. Tell me a little bit more about the vehicle itself. Do you offer different models, or is there only one particular kind that you use?
Yeah, so our newest platform is called Solo, and it's a vehicle that's sold for $9.99 at Best Buy, or around $2,000 with all the extra batteries and the backpack, et cetera. So it's fairly affordable, about the price of a laptop, and you can buy it commercially. So you can order it overnight from Amazon or REI or really anywhere that you can order a GoPro, we try and be. So we're fully integrated with GoPro for really precision cinematic shots. So that's kind of our market right now, as well as mapping. So we're a pretty seamless mapping platform that we're really excited about for collecting spatial data, which is why we're here at the AGU meeting, reaching out to scientists.
Well, and I think that's one of the really, really cool things about your product is that it's a reasonably inexpensive commercial product that now has education and academic applications. So working as someone who was in education in the academic world, how do you translate those skills to what you're doing now, and how is it being used by others?
Yeah, so I did my PhD in ecology at the University of Tennessee and then a postdoc at Berkeley. And then I was actually a professor for a couple of years with graduate students. And I ran my own lab and I applied for grants and I taught lots of students and courses in ecology. And I started using drones mostly for aerial mapping, so thinking about spatial data and time series data. Drones are just flying robots, and robots are really great at autonomous missions, but doing the same thing over and over again. Grad students are less great at that, in that they get tired and they get bored and you have to pay them and they need to eat at some point. And so a drone can really be automated to collect kind of never-ending, very precise data, and a lot of people want to use that in education. And so I left academia to join the Silicon Valley tech company, 3DR, and I'm really excited because actually I outreach to academia. That's my full-time job, is to help people integrate drones into their curriculum. So I deal with everyone from K through 12, folks that are really interested in STEM, kind of science, technology, engineering, and math outreach. That's a big push within North America. I deal with a lot of community colleges that are interested in job training using drones. People are very excited about the aerial industry that's exploding around drones. And so a lot of people are using them for job training. So a lot of real estate agents or construction sites or forestry, agriculture, mining and inspection. So all these different areas are kind of the direct target for applications of drones, as well as four-year college institutions. So there's a couple of dozen now UAV majors within North America, and those are growing every year. So some of them are doubling in size every year. It's a very popular major. And then there's lots of high-end researchers from MIT and Berkeley and Stanford and Georgia Tech and lots of people that I talk to that are either building drones themselves, working on drone research, maybe controls theory, or they're working on collision avoidance, or people are working on applications. So we deal with a lot of conservation organizations and NGOs that are using them for all sorts of reasons why you would need eyes in the sky.
It's so interesting. You know, that's the first time I've heard that there are actual academic majors now devoted to aerial vehicles and drones. So that's really interesting to see that growth there. For our listeners that maybe aren't familiar, can you explain the difference, if there is any, between a UAV and a drone?
Yeah, so some of that is this precedent. So drones themselves have had kind of a negative connotation for a lot of reasons. Both, you know, the military uses drones, and drones are used for spying, and then people see on the news a lot, like these small drones crashing, or they're worried about privacy. A lot of those are really valid concerns that we as an industry are very well aware of and are addressing in a variety of different ways that we can talk about. But UAV really comes out of the aerospace industry. That's kind of the proper term for it. That we use drone and UAV kind of interchangeably, and we'd like to destigmatize the term drone. Like, I don't really find that a negative term. We use it all the time, and so we're a little bit more casual at 3DR using them kind of as the same.
Interchangeably. Interesting. And you say you work with not just college and university-level classes, but also high school and even elementary school classes?
Yeah, so our platforms are a little bit big for elementary school, although, you know, there's lots of interest, particularly by the IT folks, in our automated cinematic shots. So we have these, so we've automated kind of the pain points of drones are really takeoff and landing, which we've made automatic, so you can just push a button. And then cinema, so before when you wanted to get really beautiful aerial photography or aerial video, you had to be a professional pilot, basically. To get the drone to move in a way that, for example, in orbit, a perfect circle is really difficult to fly by hand or manually. But we have made it so you can just push a button and you line up your shot and you press play and it orbits in this perfect circle. And you can make that circle bigger or smaller. But it's a really easy professional level shot that leads to beautiful cinema and photography. And so a lot of people are interested in that for storytelling. So I work with journalism schools and media and film And they're using these kind of smart shops for storytelling to kind of integrate into the curriculum that they already have. So you don't just need to be a drone program. A drone is just really another tool that you would add to the repertoire in your teaching. You just integrate it in and hand it to the students to train them up, and they're good to go.
So using the terminology that Nick talked about earlier is piloting. I guess you would pilot and not drive it. Can anyone pilot these, or do you need some kind of training or experience to be able to use it?
Yeah, so anyone, so the new registration came out that you have to be 13 or over to register your drone if it's over a certain payload, and ours kind of fits within there. But we've made it so it's easy enough that anyone can fly with a relatively short period of time. So you download our app to your phone. We do both Android and iOS or Apple products. From there, you can connect the app to the controller via Wi-Fi. So you just log into the controller just like you would your Wi-Fi at home. And then the Wi-Fi signal from the controller talks to the drone. So it's that simple. And so anyone really can download the app. It's free. It connects to our product. And then with a push of a button on the fly button, it goes up and it flies and it holds at, say, about 4 meters or so and waits for you to control it. So we try to make it really stable, really easy. And it uses GPS technology so that it knows where it's at, positioned on the earth, and it can hold that position. And if you want to land, you can just hold down on fly again, and it'll land. So we've made it really automated so that anyone can do it and be up and learning in just a couple of minutes.
Interesting. And I'm really curious about some of the science applications for the drone as well. So it sounds like there's some great education and some visual aspects. Can you tell us about some of the projects that scientists are working on using your drones?
Yeah, so first and foremost, scientists want to measure things. And so as an ecologist, when I want to measure something out in the field, usually I take a big roll of measuring tape, and I go out and I stretch that tape out, and then I take a square piece of PVC, and I drop it on the ground, and I count everything that's within that square, and I move on to the next, 10-meter interval on that tape. Well, now I can do that automatically from the air. And so that's really powerful. It's really going to change how science is done in the field, because now collecting data, the biggest problem is how do you manage so much data coming in and less about getting to field sites that are maybe rugged or inaccessible. And so within ecology, a lot of people are using it. For example, when we want to study climate change, one of the things we study is phenology, or the life cycle of, say, plants or animals. When are they coming out, or when are things flowering? When are they, budding out for leaves, et cetera? Those things are really painful, tedious tasks to go out and measure a plant over and over again every single day. So you can send the drone out, and you can measure everything and then come back and collect the data and analyze the data through time or analyze it later at a later date. So measuring things like phenology and climate change is a big target for drones. Here at AGU, they're interested in lots of different sensors that you can put on drones. So the drone just will fly in X, Y, and Z coordinates, so in three-dimensional space. That's why we're called 3D robotics. But then it becomes the sensor that you can put on there. And you can put lots of different sensors on drones. So you can put high-resolution cameras for mapping. That's what lots and lots of people want to do. They want to make maps. They want to make maps that are in two dimensions. They want to make three-dimensional models that they could spin around or they could print off. But people also want things like thermal cameras, so they can integrate an infrared camera, and then they can do things like survey wildlife populations, so you can see them a little bit better with a thermal camera because they're warm and they differentiate from the landscape that they're in. People want multi-spectral cameras that take different bands of light, and from that you can make maps to look at things like productivity of plants, so hot spots of areas that are high productivity, or areas that might be attacked by disease, or areas where there might be water might not be getting to. A lot of people are using those for agriculture, so thinking about farms and how do we monitor farms a little bit better? How do we manage water, and particularly in California, where we've had a drought? How do we look for irrigation leaks? How do we prevent disease outbreaks or insect attacks, et cetera? So I work with a lot of schools that want to do precision agriculture using drones. And that's kind of a big area that's growing. And then LiDAR. LiDAR is like a laser scanner, so you can get really high-precision 3D models. A lot of engineering companies are interested in drones for LiDAR so that you can come in and you can do a structural model of a construction project, for example, or a pipeline that's going in, or a road. Or you can map a forest in three dimensions and maybe estimate carbon a little bit better and how much carbon is stored in that particular forest. So lots of different applications.
Is a lot there. Now, I imagine, too, you know, with all of this data collection, this offers a great opportunity for citizen science. And, you know, the drone is available to anybody. Do you know of any projects that are currently working with that, or any scientists that are working with community-collected data using drones?
Yeah, so the drone industry is still pretty young, and there's not too many citizen science apps out there. So let me just clarify that. Our drones are linked to the cloud, and so by being linked to the cloud, it means we can connect all the drones together as spatial data collection tools. So, for example, the most expensive drone out there is the Global Hawk. It's $250 million, and it can fly for 30 hours and carry a payload over a ton. That's pretty amazing, but that's one vehicle that maybe, you know, one country can afford. You can buy 125,000 of our vehicles for that, all kitted out with cameras and extra batteries and everything. And those are 125,000 data points that you could fly with a citizen science app. For example, if you wanted a phenology app where we wanted to know across North America, what are all the plants doing? You could have 100,000 solo pilots go out and upload their phenology app and fly a kilometer transect in about 5 minutes or so, and have over 12 million data points in 5 minutes, all linked together, all sent up to the cloud, that then could be analyzed at a continental scale. So that's really the power of the cloud. And so I'm really excited to see, we have an open app development platform called DroneKit that anyone can go in. And so I predict in the college market and in the educational space, we'll start to see a lot of drone software classes starting to build apps for both controls and also data management.
Fantastic. Well, I definitely foresee some citizen apps there in the future. And your vehicles, how long can they go up in the air, and how far can they go, or does it vary?
Yeah, so our battery life right now is about 18 to 22 minutes, depending on wind conditions. We hold up really well in the wind, so we can fly up to 25, 30 mile-an-hour wind. We're based out of Berkeley, so we fly in the coastal winds all the time. We're pretty used to that. So that gets you about mapping scale of about 50 to 100 acres or so. So smaller scales. For larger scales, you need bigger vehicles, which we try and keep our vehicles small so they're really portable. We actually sell with a backpack. So you can stick the drone in a backpack and put it in your overhead and be kind of anywhere in the world in a couple hours or 12 hours or so. And then you need planes for kind of larger platforms if you want to cover thousands of acres. In North America right now, you have to stay within line of sight according to the FAA rules. And so our Wi-Fi signal broadcasts to about a half a mile is what we're confident in. If you lose Wi-Fi signal, the drone just comes home to where it took off. And so staying within that line of sight is kind of what the rules are at the moment. And we encourage people to follow the rules. And so that's kind of what we advocate.
So the million-dollar question I have to ask now, being the marine science show, is are you guys going to transition from terrestrial to marine vehicles at all?
Yeah, so right now, at 3DR, we're mostly interested in the aerial perspective. And in fact, our motto is that we help people see their world from above. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't integrate. So our autopilot, the Pixbox, is an open-source autopilot that anyone can develop on. And in fact, you can put that on a boat, you can put it on a plane, you can put it on a tractor. I've seen people put it on tractors. And you can put it on underwater vehicles. So we have researchers that are using them on underwater vehicles. Right now, kind of the consumer market really is a flying camera. And so that's why, you know, underwater vehicles tend to be fairly expensive, but the market is also a little bit more narrow and targeted. But that doesn't mean that it's not out of the question in the future.
Well, I do appreciate that. And I guess final question for you, too, is what do you hope to get out of your participation at AGDU this week? What are you guys really focused on while you're here?
Yeah, so we're really excited to be at AGDU. So we've really been outreaching to the aerial cinema market with our smart shots and our automated shots. But we're transitioning to spatial data collection, and actually a commercial UAVs are really expensive. They can be $30,000 to $50,000 to $100,000. And now we're democratizing that. We're making something available for just $1,000 or $2,000 that anyone can go out and they can collect spatial data, they can do maps. So we're excited to advocate on behalf of like both affordable but incredibly useful and powerful.
Well, Greg, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for taking some time out of the busy schedule to talk with me today. And thanks to Nick as well. I want to give a warm mahalo to both of our guests for sharing their knowledge with us, going from air to sea. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, Kosi Island Earth as well. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.